Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. While you were shopping for a Thanksgiving turkey last month, computer hackers, maybe out of Russia, were invading the networks of the U.S. military's Central Command. An attack so big and deep that George Bush and Barack Obama both got emergency briefings. And that's just one of a barrage of digital attacks and probes that go on night and day against U.S. military and economic targets. A big new report out today says it's too much, too dangerous, and has to be reined in. But can we? This hour, On Point, cyber insecurity, cyber war, and the mounting urgency of calls to up U.S. defenses. You can join the conversation. Have you seen it in your own work, your business, your computer? Hackers reaching in from anywhere in the world to read, drain, disrupt. Joining me first today from Washington is Siobhan Gorman, intelligence correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Siobhan, thank you very much for being here.
Good to be with you, Tom.
What's the drumbeat of problems that has got this commission's attention, Siobhan?
Well, the commission actually started its efforts in, I think it was August 2007, and at that time there had actually been a spate of pretty significant attacks on a whole range of federal agencies, from the Pentagon to the State Department to the Department of Homeland Security, I think NASA as well. The Commerce Department had an office that had to sort of shut down a component of its computer network, I think, for 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are pretty serious issues that intelligence officials also estimate are now costing us in the billions of dollars.
Us, as in cost to the government and costs to the American economy, private American companies?
Yes, exactly. I was speaking with someone over the weekend who mentioned that there was, I guess, an aerospace contractor. This person wasn't told which company specifically, but had an attack that was so intense, taking all kinds of data and design issues, and this is a defense contractor that's doing work for the U.S. government, that it cost them about $15 million just to recover from that particular cyber attack.
And then we've heard over the summer, we heard about John McCain and Barack Obama's campaign files being...
Yes, and Congress, too.
Congress, the White House emails that were read by somebody apparently from overseas, and these repeated attacks on the Pentagon and defense, CENTCOM, even right into Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan.
Yes.
We heard Michael Chertoff in the spring was talking about this is the head of Homeland Security, talking about a Manhattan Project-style response to all this. That already sounds like pretty big stuff. What's being proposed by this commission reporting today, Siobhan?
Well, the Manhattan Project-style effort doesn't seem to have fully come together. The current administration started about a year or so ago putting together what has become known as the Comprehensive National Cyber Security Initiative. And at the time, there was a big debate, actually, about sort of how it should be implemented, and they went for sort of a more diffuse way of implementing it, which had various components of the government attacking different parts of the problem, sort of nominally under the Department of Homeland Security. What the report that comes out today says is that that's been insufficient. It's a good start, but it's not sufficient, and it's actually not comprehensive as advertised. And so what this group of 40 technology and policy experts said was that cybersecurity isn't getting the level of attention that it needs. It needs to be treated on par with terrorism and weapons of mass destruction as threats to the country. And the only way you can do that is to get White House-level attention to it by establishing an office in the White House that is responsible for coordinating across the government and setting policy and ensuring that it's implemented.
A cybersecurity chief who would report directly to the new president, they say the battle in cyberspace is, quote, a battle we are losing.
Yes.
I think Americans are kind of sick of hearing about battles we're losing. But how significant can this be, Siobhan? I mean, after all, it sounds like it's just sort of, you know, bits and bytes and soft digital stuff.
Well, it's significant enough that most of what the government is doing on this is highly classified, and that's actually been a big problem that they've had in terms of explaining to the public why it's important. My understanding is that the last estimate for what the current administration estimates should be spent on beefing up cybersecurity is about $15 billion. And I know that in the current talk of bailouts, $15 billion doesn't seem like all that much anymore, but it actually, in terms of federal spending on programs, it's pretty significant. And I think that what the folks who monitor a lot of these cyber attacks say is that they're invisible. I mean, a lot of times you don't even know that it's going on until it's too late and people have the information. I mean, it's economic. It's got serious economic impacts in terms of loss of data or, you know, just theft of money through things like credit card fraud. And then there are the obvious national security implications of breaking into, Pentagon email systems or components of the State Department or the White House. And I think that taken together, the national security and economic impacts are what has both the folks on this commission as well as the current administration pretty alarmed.
And now the call for a new cybersecurity chief reporting directly to the president, Siobhan Gorman, intelligence correspondent for The Wall Street Journal in Washington. Siobhan, thanks very much for being with us.
Happy to do it.
With us now from Norwich, Vermont, is Scott Borg. He's director and chief economist at the U.S. Cyber Consequences Unit. It's a nonprofit research institute that investigates possible cyber attacks. He's also a member of the Center for Strategic and International Studies Commission on Cybersecurity for the 44th Presidency, which releases its report today, urging Barack Obama to deal head-on with issues of cyber insecurity. Scott Borg, thanks very much for being here.
Hello. Nice to be talking to you.
And with us is Julie Ryan, Associate Professor of Engineering Management, Systems Engineering, Information Security Management at George Washington University. She's been following the issues around cybersecurity for years now. Julie Ryan, very good to have you as well.
Hi, Tom. Siobhan, Scott, pleased to be on the board.
Siobhan's whisked off into cyberspace, but we're all here. Scott, paint the picture for us. People who are in the biz know very well what the consequences can be, but you know, outside it sounds like maybe some stolen credit cards, and how bad can it be? What's the problem with cyber insecurity? How great are the stakes here? What kind of threats are posed?
One of the biggest problems is how little understanding there is in the general public about what's at stake. When people hear about cyber attacks, they mostly think of computer networks being shut down so they can't use their credit card or buy an airplane ticket when they want. Mm-hmm. But what we're really worried about here is not people shutting down computers, not countries or foreign groups shutting down computers. We're worried about those organizations seizing control of the computers to do damage. If they take control of those computers, they can take control of almost any process in almost any physical process, any business process, any government process.
Such as what? What that would be a threat?
If you think about any of our physical facilities today, our power generation plants, our oil refineries, our factories, our chemical plants, every valve switch, every temperature, pressure, everything in that factory is controlled by a networked computer. So if you take control of those things, you can open and shut those valves, change those pressures and temperatures. So you can blow things up, you can destroy things, you can make the output of those processes be defective so that harmful things will be shipped. You can seize control of the quality control systems so that the organizations, the corporations involved don't even know that they're shipping defective products, don't even know that their system has been taken over.
It could sound far-fetched, like a conspiracy theory. Is this a real-world, real problem, threat? I don't know, is somebody in there walking around right now or recently?
Thanks to some information that was made public by CNN about 14 months ago, we can talk about one of the more dramatic examples.
Okay.
And that was a cyber attack that was demonstrated by the Idaho lab, where they set up a large generator, big enough to be a stand-in for the ones we actually use to generate electric power. And using a pure cyber attack, they physically destroyed it. They physically, utterly destroyed the thing. If you did that to a large generator, you would have to replace it. You could do that attack on 20, 40, 60 big generators at once. you could destroy them to such an extent that it would take many months, perhaps a couple of years, to put them back up again.
You're talking about wide swaths of America without electricity for a couple of years?
Well, for certainly several months. And this is just horrendous economic damage. This is economic damage that's hard to imagine.
That's it sounds like on a scale with a nuclear attack, but is there any evidence that people are in there snooping around, probing around, preparing to potentially do such a thing?
Yes, for sure. We've had very extensive probes into all of these systems. Right now, the people who want to do this don't have the capability. The countries that have the capability don't want to do this. But we need to assume right now that China, Russia, and a number of other technologically advanced countries in the world could do this right now. They could turn off our electric power. This is a terrifying situation.
Julie, it makes our Pentagon defenses seem... we know they're mighty, but if you can come in, you know, right past all the jets and missiles and turn off all the power, shut off American industry, it makes the formal defenses seem kind of, misdirected, inadequate, superfluous somehow?
Well, there's an interesting discussion that's probably not appropriate right now about what it means to have national security. And I think, apropos of what Scott was talking about, probably it would be more effective to threaten to shut stuff down than to actually do it. That could be done by organized crime to extort, somewhat similar to what the pirates are doing off Somalia right now, holding boats for hostage. Organized crime could hold generators for hostage.
It sounds like a Lex Luthor fantasy, but is this a real threat?
Yes, it is a real threat, and I took the privilege of printing out some material to bring to the conversation today from 2000.
Hold on to it, Julie. We've got to take a short break. We'll come right back to that information. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about cyber insecurity and the mounting call for the U.S. to secure the digital homeland, about U.S. military and commercial interests at risk digitally. We're joined by Julie Ryan from George Washington University, joins us from Washington, from Norwich, Vermont, by Scott Borg with the U.S. Cyber Consequences Unit. Big new report out today, and Scott Borg's part of the group that did it, saying we need a new cybersecurity chief at the elbow of the President of the United States. And many instances in recent weeks and months of quite astonishing digital invasions right into American industry, into the heart of the American defense establishment, defense contractors. Julie, we'll be joined in a moment by John Arquilla, who's looked at this very closely from Monterey, California. But Julie, you're about to take us through a list there. Tell us about it.
Well, what I was going to talk to you about was in the year 2000, a engineer in Australia, in Moroki Shire, quit his job. He worked at a wastewater treatment facility, and the wastewater treatment facility was controlled by a SCADA system. And SCADA stands for Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition. It is a specialized network system for controlling the large types of infrastructure elements that Scott was referring to in his bit. And what this young man did, his name was Vitek Bowden, he actually hacked into the system after he had quit his job and started dumping wastewater into the environmentally sensitive area around Moroki Shire. And he did this in order to get a contract with the wastewater treatment facility in order to fix the problem that he himself was causing. And he actually hacked into the system 46 times before they caught him and sent him to jail. But this is a fairly dramatic illustration of what can be done by one person against an infrastructure facility.
Scott, that sounds like this is an issue of disgruntled former employees, maybe people looking for business, but I think what you and Julie and others are describing is a potentially grand-scale intervention. I mean, who are we talking about here? Is this gangs? Is this governments? In what circumstances might they act? You mentioned power. What other kind of infrastructure has been snooped around on, messed with already?
One of the things that's happened here is that we've entered an era, it's a whole new defense era. It's really transformed everything so utterly that you have to almost start over and rethink every aspect of national security. We've entered an era where nation states, ethno-nationalists, ideological militants, criminal organizations, groups that are very large and groups that are really quite small, can all carry out similar kinds of attacks. They can all carry out attacks that would rise to the level of being a national security concern. So we're talking now always about a huge spectrum when one of these things happen. And because of the nature of cyber attacks, you can't tell who's attacking. So if we were attacked in a serious way, it would be very hard for us to tell whether it was China or whether it was Al-Qaeda or whether it was a group of deranged hackers living down the block.
And what I'm trying to get out on the table here is, I mean, I've read a lot about it, but I wish you'd tell. And what I'm reading here are reports of what sound like hackers sort of rampaging through American computers all over the place all the time, that it's not as though there's some secure defense that's occasionally breached, but that the breach is almost constant, Scott.
There are many levels of systems to go rampaging through, as you put it. Some of them are really not entered very often and are only entered by very, very sophisticated attackers. Others of them are almost wide open and have all kinds of folks in them all the time. So we've got – it's a big subject with many different levels of actors and many different levels of targets and many different things you can do once you're inside. And that's what makes the transformation so comprehensive and so difficult to get a handle on.
Let's turn to Monterey, California, and our friend John Arquilla, professor of defense analysis at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School. He specializes in unconventional warfare and terrorism. He's author of Worst Enemy, The Reluctant Transformation of the American Military. John, welcome back. Good to have you.
Hi, Tom.
I wish you could convey in simple terms some of the vulnerabilities of just the U.S. military, for starters. Here, I mean, I'm reading about military systems that maybe or are wide open. You know, U.S. I don't know, military planes where their very controls may not be fully in American hands.
Well, I think the military, like our commercial sector, is empowered by information technology, and it's imperiled by it at the same time because we have adversaries who've learn to ride the rails of this advanced technology to strike at us. And in the case of our military, as well as most of our business and power infrastructure, we're highly dependent on very automated systems. An air campaign that you mentioned a moment ago has something called an air tasking order. Today, that's done by an entirely automated program. In fact, they don't have people who can actually reconstruct them anymore. So if a hacker were to get in and disable that tasking order software, it would take us days or weeks to try to cobble together something manually. Similarly, automated programs that coordinate the movement of troops and their equipment, something called time-phased force deployment, is entirely automated. Very hard to do manually, would slow us down greatly. These are big effects that would be felt on the battlefield. Think, for example, of a conflict on the Korean Peninsula, mm-hmm. where if you were slowed by a week or two in responding with either an air campaign or movement of forces. We only have a very small number of forces there, and the North Koreans have about 1 million troops on the oddly named demilitarized zone.
Mm-hmm.
And so assume what that looks like with a Seoul, Korea that's already in artillery range. Lots of lives could be lost. This is, in itself, the cyber attack is not destructive per se. It is rather disruptive, but it's the secondary effects in the military sense that we look at. What does this do to us on the battlefield? And what we know is that this can have a very crippling effect on us.
But John, in plain language, my sense is, from doing some background reading here, this is not hypothetical, that the hackers, many of them may be at the order of foreign governments, are already in. They've already, their footprints all over the place inside our defense establishment. Am I wrong?
No, you're right, and it's been going on for over a decade with something that we can refer to as Moonlight Maze about a decade ago, with a series of systematic intrusions that went on for a very long time that is measured in years, and I'm afraid we can't say more about that. What we can say is that these were exploitative. They sought information. They did not seek to do disruption. I think we haven't seen the kind of attack that disrupts our forces in the field, because there hasn't been a battlefield situation from which the adversary would benefit by crippling us. So we're lucky in that regard. But the clock is ticking, and I'm sorry to say I've been working this issue very closely for about 15 years, and I'm sorry to say that our level of security is only marginally better today than it was a long time ago. Sadly, I try to reach our military officers on a level they understand clearly, so I use the metaphor of the Maginot Line, which everyone knows was a great fortification and didn't work.
In France, against the Germans, against the Nazis, they just drove around it in their tanks.
Drove around it, and that's what's happening in cyberspace. We're erecting all sorts of Maginot Lines, firewalls, all great walls in cyberspace, and basically they'll always get through. We instead of Maginot Lines, we have to imagine no lines. They will always be in there. And so we have to think in terms of defenses that exist even when the bad guys are all around us. And that means usually a strong encryption for all information. That's a particular policy that we've had a lot of trouble getting traction on for many, many years.
Now, this is actually central and understood to be central to Chinese defense policy, just to take one, right? I mean, not to... if there were to be a conflict with the United States, not to take them head-on, but to use electronics to disrupt the mighty American military machine.
Yeah, the Chinese call the doctrine unrestricted warfare, which includes a variety of forms of strategic attack. That is ways to get at the enemy without engaging their forces directly. This is one. But I'd also say, in terms of Russia, the bear is in the matrix. A Moonlight Maze a decade ago was thought to be somehow connected to the Russians. Recent events in Estonia have some kind of Russian fingerprints. In Georgia, forces moved in, conventional forces, there were irregular forces, and there were cyber forces acting in concert with each other. So it's pretty clear the bear is in the matrix, too.
Let's begin to take some calls here from Medford, Massachusetts. Philip, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. It's very interesting, the problems, but I'm rather more interested about what we're going to be doing to try and stop them.
Good.
Solve the problem. In particular, over the weekend, we had an example where a hoax telephone call to the Pakistani Minister of Defense almost caused a war.
Right. This was someone who called it very belligerent, posing as a high Indian official.
Yes, and we had incidents in this campaign. Somebody pretended to be the French president to Palin, and then recently we had the reverse when a congressman blew off... Obama when thinking that he was a hoax.
But that's as old as crank telephone calls. I mean, we're talking digital insecurity, cyber warfare.
Yes, but the thing is that the telephone system and the internet, they're both just means of communication. And the thing that we have here is we have people who are able to get inside our communication lines and impersonate. And that is a major security problem. The real security problems have always been authentication, much more than encryption. That's what the Navajo Code talkers were about. It was stopping the Japanese from impersonating Americans, not about protecting the encryption, the confidentiality of the messages.
Philip, let us pick that up, if we may. Julie Ryan, what about it? I mean, you can see if some digital message or fake attack comes through, which makes it look as though country X, Y, or Z, or organization X, Y, or Z is attacking the United States, there's a real problem of the U.S. responding to something that they can't authenticate.
Well, I have to agree with John on this point. Stronger encryption can go a long way to solving some of the problems. And most on point, the confidentiality issues and the integrity issues, and the integrity gets to the point of authentication. If you've got public key encryption, you can set up authentication schemes that give you a fairly high degree of assurance that you know who you're talking to. But this is a really huge problem, because right now we don't know how to judge our security. We don't know what works. We don't know what doesn't work. We have some sense that antivirus software does something to keep the predictable viruses from attacking your computers, but what about the unpredictable ones, the ones that haven't been discovered yet? We have some sense that firewalls will keep rogue packets out of your networks, but only in accordance to the policy rules that you've set up. And it's possible for attacks to get in stealth mode and sneak in under the policy radar screen, if you will. the way that we sort of judge security today is by counting things. And that's fine for counting things, but it doesn't tell you whether or not your security is effective. And the problem with judging whether your security is effective or not is really you're trying to judge a negative. If nothing happens, is it because nobody attacked you? Is it because your security worked? Or is it because you did not detect that you were being attacked? And in large part, our sense is that it's the third thing, that we're just not detecting. And we have good reason for thinking that, because we see the effects of what happens when our systems have been compromised. I strongly agree that there needs to be leadership on this. The whole notion of Manhattan Project has been one that's been kicked around for 15 or 20 years now. There's been cyber czars in the White House before. But, the Administrative Procedures Act, the same act that covers things like the FCC, gives the U.S. government strong power to regulate things, and that's what needs to be done. There needs to be regulation on software developers. There needs to be regulation on equipment manufacturers. There needs to be the ability to hold people liable for bad systems.
So regulation, of course, a lot of this isn't even produced in this country, though. Let's go to Nick in Worcester, Massachusetts. Nick, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. How you doing?
Good. Well, what do you know?
I currently work for a company who does work on power plants, and I'm an instruments and controls engineer.
Okay.
There are no... I'm revisiting the issue of power plants being able to be controlled from outside.
Right, the idea of reaching in digitally, screwing one up for months or years, and leaving a lot of people in the dark.
Yeah. I'm not sure if that information that you may have is entirely accurate, because I believe that it's generally accepted as a big no-no in the industry to have a process control computer be connected to an outside network.
For exactly this reason.
Yeah, exactly.
Can I comment on that?
It's not like the designers aren't thinking about these threats and are kind of just throwing this thing. Might as well check your local email while you're working this power plant. It just doesn't happen that way.
Nick, let me take that to Scott Borg, who raised the issue. Scott, what do you say? They're not just on online.
The organization I run has had people on the ground in power plants, in electrical control centers, the control centers for the grid, in all of these other facilities, checking out exactly what's possible and what isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true that a lot of things people worry about are very difficult to do. But there's some big misunderstandings here. One misunderstanding is that is the idea that you have to be connected to the Internet in order to be vulnerable to an attack. In fact, there's no need for somebody launching an attack to be in control of that in real time when it happens. All you need to do is to be able to insert a piece of malicious code, a malicious program, into that system at some point by some means.
How might that have happened if not via the Internet?
No systems can operate without new software, new updates, new information.
But
when
will they even be injected?
All the time.
Would they have been built in when they were first constructed, or someone strolls into the plant and somehow, sits down at one desk and plugs? How would it happen?
There are a lot of ways in which it can happen. For one thing, whenever you've got a system that's a critical system, it's being manned by very smart people who are very bored. It's running 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, and you've got clever people sitting in there who are very bored. And so one of the questions we regularly ask when we are visiting these facilities is, we say, well, did you ever find anything in this system that isn't supposed to be there? And the answer is almost never no. There are computer games. The thing we've been hearing about lately are programs for writing screenplays. People who are in critical facilities that are bored are often trying to write the new Hollywood blockbuster.
They're sitting around like William Faulkner writing their first novel while they're monitoring power plant security.
Absolutely. And all kinds of other stuff is in there that isn't supposed to be. We also constantly find connections that are undocumented. We are told by the security people that their system is isolated. And we say, well, do you mind if we check? And we find all kinds of connections to the corporate network, usually, that aren't supposed to be there, that the security people often don't even know about.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about cyber insecurity, cyber war, and the mounting call for the U.S. to secure the digital homeland, U.S. military and commercial interests at risk in ways we may never have fully considered. Scott Borg is with us from Norwich, Vermont, in the U.S. Cyber Consequences Unit. Julie Ryan is here from George Washington University. And John Arquilla, professor of defense analysis at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School, author of Worst Enemy. Let's get a call from Oxford, Iowa, and Kyla. Kyla, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank
Hi.
You.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to ask if these cyber attacks and counterattacks and so forth aren't like the new nuclear weapons, because China and Russia have to develop some kind of defense about what we are trying to do to them. Now, you have only mentioned what they, the ones out there, are trying to penetrate the United States, but you don't mention one word that the United States is doing the same thing for them. So if they don't develop some kind of deterrence, they're very vulnerable to a U.S. cyber attack.
Kylie, it's an excellent point and question, and let us pick it up. John Arquilla, what do you say to that?
Well, I think the simplest distinction is that nuclear weapons are mass destructive. Cyber weapons are, at best, one day going to be mass disruptive. There'd be a lot less loss of life. In terms of pure warfare, if we lived in a world where nations fought by cyber means, there could be a lot less destruction, a lot less loss of life. Some people have accused me over the years of trying to, quote, make war better with my concept of cyber warfare. And I think it's something that in every era in history, weapons advances have form new modes of war, and you have to do business in different ways. We can't go back and forget how to make these cyber weapons, so I think we're going to have to live with them, and the caller is absolutely right. We have, in order to defend yourself, you have to know how attacks occur, and so we and other countries and a lot of non-state actors and networks have capabilities like this, and so we have to talk about whether some kind of offensive action is something that should be contemplated or whether there should be arms control. I know that this CSIS report is going to discuss the need for diplomacy and a kind of arms control. It's harder than in the nuclear realm. Few people can get their hands on fissile material. Just about everybody can get their hands on the tools they need to wage cyber warfare. So it would have to be a sort of behavior-based agreement like we have with chemical weapons, for example. We've been pretty good about keeping those from spreading. So we do have to try some kind of arms control.
But, John, is there a deterrence strategy up on the rails already, a U.S. deterrence strategy? Would China or Russia have to assume that if they shut down a bunch of power plants or pipelines or you name it in the United States that there would be a counterstrike? Or are you suggesting that we have not honed that kind of offensive capacity to the same degree that, that potential adversaries may have?
Well, the issue of cyber deterrence is one that President Bush has been very interested in over the past year, and I'm sure that the president-elect is going to continue that interest. One of the problems with deterrence of cyber warfare is something Scott referred to earlier, the veil of anonymity about the perpetrator. You may not know who's attacking you. 10 years ago, I wrote a short story about how a terror network almost fomented a world war, not just with cyber weapons, but other weapons, because a country was so mad at all these cyber attacks and thought another country had been fingered as having committed these acts. So we have to be very, very careful, because deception could cause conflict escalation. So deterrence, we certainly have to try to do this, but it is going to be a lot more complex because many, many more actors have access to the weapons. There's greater ambiguity about who's perpetrating these acts. It's a tough game. The good news is that both the Russians and the Chinese have at different times talked about the need to arrive at some kind of controls, and I think we saw an existence proof of our own restraint in the Kosovo War 9 years ago. President Clinton knew that we had very considerable capabilities to use cyber attack against infrastructure and a variety of targets against our Serbian foes. And he made a decision not to be the one to suggest that this was a form of war that should be easily resorted to. And I think there's been a great deal of circumspection on the part of nations, really limiting their actions to trying to gain intelligence. And that's something that, if I may for just 30 seconds, say we're talking a lot about protection. We're really not yet talking about the more proactive uses of cyberspace. If we and others have these capabilities, what it really means is that intelligence gathering needs to move more and more into this virtual domain. We spend in America about $1 billion a week on intelligence. Most of that goes for satellites and other technical systems that have diminishing returns at best, particularly against networks. And human intelligence is something that's been in disarray for decades. So I've been suggesting that we can create a kind of virtual human intelligence by developing these means through cyberspace to reconstruct every keystroke that an adversary is hitting, and really need to develop this. And I hope that that's one of the things that gets a little more attention in the years ahead. As far as Manhattan Project's concerned, that may be the wrong metaphor. I think what we're really looking for is a new Bletchley Park. In World War II, the advanced information scientists of the time learned how to break the most advanced codes, get inside the opponent's system, and they really had a war-winning advantage. If we're ever going to track down the terrorists, it will only be through cyberspace. That's how they run their network in 80 countries. And as a former vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs said to me a year or so back, we've given the enemy a free ride in cyberspace. So I hope the new Cyber Czar or the Cyber Command gets serious about taking cyberspace away from these pernicious enemies.
Well, so many issues there. Scott Borg, first of all, to the self-control of China or Russia, I have to say, even, you know, just from the outside, reading in through news reports, it doesn't look that controlled, that contained to me. And then there's the issue of damage. I mean, you know, you've said that digital attacks could be practically tantamount to nuclear attacks I mean, not the same kind of physical damage, but real physical on-the-ground damage.
Yeah, there are a number of points here. John Arquilla just outlined what would be a whole series of hour-long discussions. I should mention to listeners that John is one of the principal theorists of this whole new defense era that we've moved into. One of the architects of network-centric warfare, mm-hmm. which was the first phase of it, and one of the people that's helping lead the way into all these problems that we're dealing with now. One thing I would very much like to draw attention to here is that the attacks that we've already experienced could easily have consequences that we haven't felt yet and won't feel for years.
Flesh that out.
If a country has the capability of turning off our electric power, it would be a good idea for them to just sit on that capability, perhaps let us know that they've got it, and let it influence our negotiations, for instance. Say we are in a negotiating situation with a foreign power about something fairly tense. If we know they can turn off our electricity for months, we can't push as hard as we would otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
An even more immediate consequence that we're going to feel in the future is the enormous loss of competitiveness due to all of the massive information theft. We have foreign groups, hostile groups, sucking all of the information out of our corporations right now. They're taking all of the control settings out of the physical plants, all of the business plans out of the corporate systems, and they're beginning to utilize those as they enter these businesses internationally in a global market.
So they've got a leg up before they even begin, or as they compete, they're sort of reading our homework over our shoulder.
If you've siphoned the information out of one of our plants, you can open a new facility, a new manufacturing facility, a new chemical plant, and on day one have a level of efficiency that it took the market leader in America maybe 6 years to get to.
Is that happening?
Yes. It's definitely happening. It's very dangerous to talk about. Those of us who've investigated cases have been warned that if we ever name a particular case, we will be sued by the company that lost their information, by the senior management of that company who fear shareholder lawsuits, by the foreign company that stole the information and is benefiting from it, by the distributors and business partners of that foreign corporation.
But all that doesn't make it any less real as a loss to the U.S. economy.
So we're seeing an enormous economic loss. The biggest economic effect of cyber attacks is not information. It's not identity theft. It's not the kind of small-scale fraud that we hear about all the time. The big economic effect right now is the loss of business information, the loss of competitive information. And yet, in order to talk about it, you need to be able to cite examples so that people will believe you, and we don't dare. Those of us who've investigated it don't dare cite examples because we'd be tied up in court for the next decade.
Julie Ryan, and yet American industry is servicing the American security institutions. I mean, from the Pentagon right on around. For all I know, Robert Gates is using running on Windows as Secretary of Defense. What happens in the commercial arena, even apart from the competitive angle of it, which is huge, can also have direct implications for our security establishment.
Well, absolutely. I mean, everything is connected, and that's the big notion there. I don't remember whether it was Scott or John saying that. Nothing can operate without software updates, and the same is true of the Pentagon. And they have to work on interoperable software systems that everybody can use. So, yeah, they've got to use Microsoft PowerPoint. They've got to use Microsoft Excel. That's how business is done, even inside the Pentagon. So there's some attempt to separate out these networks through air gaps and encryption and other sort of separations. But then you've got people walking in with thumb drives and diskettes and other kind of removable media that introduce outside peril to the inside networks.
Let's take a call from James in Sumter, South Carolina. James, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I work for Fraser Tire Service in Sumter, South Carolina.
Yes.
And basically, I do their network in the evening. It's a pretty common procedure where a company can't afford a network administrator at $100 an hour. They hire someone like me.
Okay.
Well, I've seen plenty of vulnerabilities. One in particular, South Carolina Highway Patrol. They have a login screen on the front page of their website.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you simply type in the full URL, you can see full Social Security numbers, driver's license numbers, FBI numbers, VIN numbers.
I encourage everyone to forget they just heard that, or South Carolina Highway Patrol to close that down right now.
Yes, sir. And these are types of vulnerabilities that they don't even know is going on. People are viewing this data on a daily basis. I find things in my computer network. We have about 35 PCs. I find things you wouldn't believe. And it's just like the gentleman was saying. Most people will not admit to it. I'm nervous. I get nervous talking about it. There's tons of data out there flowing out of these computers at a rate you would not even believe.
And that's just a view from a tire company in South Carolina. James, we appreciate your firsthand kind of testimony there. John Urquilla, what about what just happened at CENTCOM a couple of weeks ago? What was that about? And you've talked about protecting stuff by taking it up into the information cloud. Give us a tour of what happened and how a different approach might be more effective.
I'm afraid I'm not at liberty to say much of the details of what went on. There are routinely...
President Bush was briefed. Obama was briefed.
I'm afraid I can't brief you.
No, but it was in the papers. It's hardly a secret. A bunch of it.
Well, I think the details are very, very troubling in terms of the series of intrusions that are made, and indeed throughout all of the Defense Department, thousands of attacks or intrusions are made on a daily basis. Very little disruption is done. The problem is access to very, very sensitive information about plans and operations and intelligence. And again, this is you may be able to talk about this mm-hmm. in the public sector. On my side, it's all treated as very classified. What people should take from this is the fact that our system that upon which we spend billions of dollars every year is almost entirely insecure from intrusion. And this gives the enemy an edge in the battlefield. It gives him an edge plotting the next terror attack, gives him an edge knowing what we're doing and we don't know what he's doing. And that's one of the reasons I'm suggesting we need to become more proactive. But for the average American, I would only say, and I'm sad and sorry to say this, that the gentleman from South Carolina is not unique. These problems exist throughout our defense establishment, and our defenses, because they are Maginot Line-like, are porous. And yes, I've argued for moving a lot of information out into the cloud of the web. That's certainly what our enemies do. They put their information out there where we can't find it. It's cyberspace is a huge constructed domain that gets exponentially larger every 6 or 8 months. And it seems to me that that's a place where we could put a lot of information securely that our adversaries would never get at. So we have to think a little bit like the enemy as we try to secure ourselves in the months and years ahead. Mm.
Scott Borg, what's your broad prescription for how to address this current, real, and ongoing vulnerability?
Well, we need to recognize that it is an ongoing problem, that we have really entered a new defense era, a new security era, and that it has to be dealt with on many different levels. I heartily endorse most of the recommendations of this commission that I've been serving on, of this report that's been released today. But there's an adjustment of thinking here. Let me give you an example. One of the electric power companies that had certain vulnerabilities that we find worrisome, not the one that I referred to earlier, but but another one that was very bad, that electric power company wanted to remedy that. In order to do it, they had to pass on a very, very tiny bit of that charge to their customers. They had to increase by a small fraction of a penny the amount that people would be paying for electricity. And the regulatory body, the public commission that had to authorize them to do that, was unwilling to authorize that very slight increase because they wouldn't take the cyber threat seriously, and they said that the general public wouldn't stand for it.
And so it went so on wide open.
So there's a big change in awareness of consciousness that has to take place in order for us to deal with this problem. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so delighted to be talking on this program, and so why I'm so delighted that you're giving it this coverage.
Well, we're trying right here, right now. It's vast and kind of overwhelming, but we're beginning to take it on board, at least in our small arena. Scott Borg with the U.S. Cyber Consequences Unit in Norwich, Vermont. It's wonderful to have you with us today. Thank you very much for joining us, Scott.
Thank you.
And Julie Ryan at George Washington University, joining us today from Washington. Julie, thank you so much for being here.
A pleasure.
John R. Quill at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. John, thanks for coming.
You're welcome, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.